I got poopies!
Oh!
In tech we trust. Charge we're not sure about.
Hello, it's episode 89 of the In Tech We Trust podcast, and I'm coming to you live today. Not live, because of course I'm always like about a week late publishing the podcast. I'm going to get better at that, but I'm joined today by Lauren and by Gabriel. How is everybody?
Doing great.
Awesome.
Wee. So, Lauren, you're just down the road from me, right?
I am. I just had some fish and chips.
You had fish and chips, yeah? So you're in London.
I am, and enjoying it so far. I just got here, though, like a half hour ago. So my first priority was getting on this podcast.
Of course, yeah. Now, I'm just up the road in Manchester, so if you stick your shoes on, you can have a wander up if you want. It's a small place, England.
Yeah, I'll be there in, what, like a couple hours or so?
Oh, yeah, a couple of days if you walk it.
Can't you get everywhere through the tube?
Well, not this far north. Come on, we barely have electricity here. Anyway, never mind, because we're joined today by somebody super special who is actually joining the podcast as a co-host to kind of whip us into line. So can we get a big cheer for Yadin Porter de Leon? Woohoo!
Yay!
Oh my goodness. The warm welcome. It's fantastic. You know what? We are missing a nice drum roll by Mr. Farley.
Where is he when you need him, right?
Now that would have completed my onboarding process.
It would, and a hey now as well.
Yeah.
So go on, Yadin. Why don't you just give us like a quick 30-second, 60-second spiel on who you are, what you do, and why people should care that you've joined us on the podcast. In fact, actually, treat this like an interview, right? As if we hadn't given you the role already. Sell yourself to us and the listeners. What is good about you?
Well, I have to say that my contribution here, you know, Mark actually sold me on the fact that I would just be talking about beer, but it sounds like you guys actually talk about some serious subjects. So on a serious note, I actually work for a pretty mature startup in Silicon Valley, and I work with our largest enterprise customers. So think AIG, think Dell, and I'm the one who basically goes in, becomes a change agent within the company and helps them with the global deployments for what we do. You won't hear me plug the product because, as I told Nigel, I do that plenty during the day. So you won't hear much about Druva or what we sell over there. But you will hear a lot about the large enterprise customers that I work with on a daily basis, what they're experiencing, what their opinions are on the trends that are currently going on in the market, and most importantly, what's dysfunctional with large enterprise organizations today, which is my favorite topic.
Or surely what's not dysfunctional, because that would be a much shorter list.
That would be a very, in fact, I'm not sure anyone would be on that list, actually.
Yes, true. Hey, so I think I'm going to have a bone to pick with Farley here. What is it that Druva do?
What Druva does, and this is the spiel at the top, we're the leader in converged data protection. And you might say to yourself, well, what does that actually mean? And you would be right in asking yourself that, because that's something that the marketing team came up with very creatively. And actually, it does mean something when you drill down into it. But basically, at its core, it's backup and data analytics. So we basically capture people's data, whether it's endpoints or whether it's, you know, servers. We grab it, but then we also provide them some analytics to be able to search across all of those. And so when I work with clients, I'm really touching everything from on-prem environments to cloud deployments. So that gives me an insight into all the components of organizations in which people go from deployment to help desk to all of the executives who are sponsoring to what's really more important right now, which is a large part of my background, which is the legal component of it. So think compliance. Think global regulatory data privacy laws. Think, you know, legal hold and litigation. And there's a lot of that going on in the tech industry, as you know. And so one of my specialties actually is working with a lot of these large organizations to understand how the data they have and what they're doing with it and what different people are doing with that data within their organization, what legal ramifications that have, what regulatory ramifications that have. And I'll find myself a lot of times in a room just chatting with people about, well, what is this new Russia thing? Or EU privacy shield is, you know, falling apart. What do we do? And people running around with their hair caught on fire asking me interesting questions like that. So that's it in a nutshell.
Well, you're saying think this and think that. And you know what? I don't mean any disrespect when I say this. I'm thinking two things, right? I'm thinking one, oh man, that sounds so boring, right? it's probably a good thing you bring a different angle. But the other thing is, the other thing I'm thinking, right, is why I said I've got a bone to pick with Farley, is we've got Mark, who's a storage expert. We've got Gabriel, who's a storage expert. We've got Rick, who's a storage expert. And we've got you now, who's a storage expert, which leaves Lonely Lauren as our networking guru. And we never talk about networking because I'm like a shocking podcast host. And me as the lonely container guy, we're like, oh, we're so storage heavy.
Yeah, see, that's where you're wrong, Nigel. I'm not a storage expert.
You're not.
You're in good company. No, but I am an infrastructure and production environment cloud deployment guru. And my focus in the organization is professional services. So I'm, as I like to say, I'm a part of the department of get or done. So there's a lot of things that I feedback all of this stuff from clients back into product and the engineering team. So I'm the one who kind of acts as the glue between sales, product, marketing, development, engineering, and the customers to kind of bring all of that stuff together. So when you talk about sort of my areas of focus, I'm really finding out, well, how are people deploying this? And how are we personally using Docker on AWS to you know, work with our own product? And how is that affecting the clients? And just today, we came up with a client who's ingesting our APIs. You know, how do we do versioning for the APIs in order to make sure that their code doesn't break? That's what I do. So don't think of me as the storage expert guy.
No, I won't. You know what, though? You got the job, so cool.
Now, excellent.
One other thing that we're not going to talk about this week is, but you do homebrew beer, don't you?
I do indeed. I do.
At some point in the future, when we've got Mark on the show, we'll have a quick 5-minute chit-chat about that. But one of our mantras these days is try and get to the content quicker. So welcome to the podcast. I'm sure it's going to be a pleasure. You come across really loud and clear, and you sound better than all of us, right? So it's probably going to be your podcast pretty soon. Never mind. So let's run through the news for the week, right? Tech news first, right? Now, I don't think this one can be true, but word is that Oracle recently experienced a cloud capacity shortage. And I'm wondering if that's like the political way of saying the thing doesn't freaking exist. Have Microsoft got the magic back? I'm starting to wonder if they have, right? They announced Microsoft Free BSD for Azure. Cool. 32 million Twitter passwords have been hacked. Though I love this. Apparently, most of them are 123456. Get in. Now, business news. Longtime Cisco innovation legends are leaving the company. Oh, another Oracle one here, right? I guess their cloud must be real because they're being sued in two separate cases over apparently inflating their cloud revenue figures. Though I am telling you, right, the thing doesn't freaking exist, so they're inflating it from zero to anything. What else have we got? Storage related, IDC listing NetApp as number 2 for revenue in the all-flash market. And last but not least, apparently Huawei are outspending Apple. Actually, you know, before we go and talk about any of those, Yadin, quick question for you, right? How do you pronounce Huawei?
You got it right, Huawei. I mean, if you can do the accent in Chinese, it sounds way better, though.
Come on, let's hear it then.
Oh, no, I can't do it. I was just saying if you could.
Well, Lauren's going to do it, I think. She's got skills there.
I pretty much am the same as an Asian person, right? No, I can't say it. I mean, Huawei is how I would say it, too. I'm from the Midwest. There's no accent.
I think the first time I ever saw it, it says, Huawei?
Yeah.
But no, it's actually Huawei. Yeah.
Huawei. Okay. Lauren, you can do it in your scary poltergeist voice, though, yeah?
Huawei.
Oh, wow.
You
can.
Yeah. You know what? They should actually pay you and use that with every commercial that they have.
Come by.
Huawei.
See, I thought it was just a clever audio filter you had, Lauren, but that actually is real.
It is. It's real. It's the same give me a keg of beer that you might find from Teen Wolf.
You remember that as well. You just set me back in time.
Yep. Yeah.
So this one about Oracle apparently experiencing cloud capacity issues, right? I don't know if anybody particularly wants to take the lead on this one. Has got much to say. It seems to me, I don't know. I know we joke about the Oracle Cloud and, you know, it's going to be as big as Azure or Amazon Web Services in 10 years, according to Larry. But the thing is, if they can't even get capacity management right, I mean, what hope is there?
Do you think this is like like the equivalent, maybe they leaked the story and the equivalent of having like a cool new club, but you don't let anyone in yet, you know, like so there's a lineup to try and get
like,
it.
It could be. It's so busy. There's so much demand. It's growing.
So many people want in.
Yeah.
I mean, so the one thing that Oracle does really well is sell stuff, right? So you have a bunch of, you know, Oracle salespeople running out there and selling a service, and apparently they just didn't size it appropriately for the demand. And now they're telling people, it's like, hey, you got to back off and chill out, you know, or we can't guarantee the services that you have. I mean, it's a, I think it's a fairly common challenge that many service providers have or cloud providers have, because they have, you know, they have to learn how to walk before they can crawl and then run. It looks like Oracle went directly to trying to run without doing the other two steps.
So a potential disconnect between what the sales teams are selling and what they're able to deliver on the back end, right? Which I'm sure is quite complicated, actually, but it's pretty fundamental at the end of the day as well.
I'm still confused about what Oracle Cloud is. I mean, I was reading an article earlier today that, you know, was talking about how it's really just a bunch of Hyperion servers that lie on-premises, like reside on-premises at the customer site, and they're calling it cloud services.
Surely not.
I mean, that's part of the stuff that goes into the inflated cloud pricing, surely too.
Not. Well, the thing is, I do know that the multipliers that their sales guys were getting for selling anything with cloud in the title was like crazy. So I imagine there is at least an element of, not creative accounting here, but creative bookkeeping or something. You know what I mean, right? Where sales guys are selling stuff with cloud in the title that's potentially not really cloud. And what, Hyperion servers on premises? I mean, that is about as far from the cloud as you can get, right?
Is there such a thing as private cloud as a service?
That's what private cloud is, right? But I don't think that's what they're, you know, billing it as
trying to sell it.
Hyperion on premises is definitely the definition of modern cloud computing.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, so I've got some notes here. Apparently, it was in their infrastructure as a service and Exadata database as a service. Those were the two areas that were affected. So one of the stories that I read was that, okay, it's one thing to sell a lot of cloud, right? But you want repeat customers, don't you? You want that cloud experience to be sticky so that they come back for more. And one, I think they had... I guess obviously somebody that didn't want to be named, but they were citing somebody apparently in the know that was saying along the lines of, yeah, they'd sold a bunch of stuff to customers, but then there was this like secondary big push to say, well, it's one thing to sell it to customers, but we want those customers to come back. So pick up the phone like five times a day and say, we haven't noticed you're logging in, you better log in. And it could have been, you know, I guess something off the back of that, that suddenly, yeah, they've sold all of this stuff and utilization's potentially really low. And then they tell the sales force, get your butt into gear, make sure that these people are starting to use it. And if you start flooding all of your customers saying, you've got to start using it, you've got to start using it. And guess what? Shock, horror, maybe they do. Then you potentially have some issues. I don't know.
The bottom line is that, you know, sales staff are coin operated, and if you give them an accelerator on a small bucket, guess what? They're going to go out there and sell the small bucket till the cows come home, and try to kill their number and make a bunch of money, and you know that's what happens. And then you know it's kind of like if you go sell a new widget and you don't have enough demand, or you didn't anticipate the amount of demand for the widget, it's going to come back and bite you in the ass. And so they overpromised and underdelivered, and that's, you know, they give you a black
eye.
But
it's a large organization, right? You've got to have your sales guys and your internal ability to deliver on those sales lined up better than, well, look.
But then again, keep in mind, you know, it's if they took their standard Oracle database sales teams and tried to pivot them into being cloud services sales teams, and that wasn't their core competency, guess what? They're going to, you know, to them it's just, hey, I'm a sales guy, I sell it, right? They don't worry about the details. They wait for the check to clear, and then they go, you know, hookers and blow. But there's some reality to that particular aspect. I hope that the product managers, the business managers, the line of business service people, the implementation groups, I mean, you hope that they actually put some thought into this and just didn't turn some stuff off and run with it. But, you know, stranger has happened.
It has, no doubt. Okay, so I'll tell you what, from one Goliath of a company to another, but I'm hoping kind of a more positive spin on this one, right? I am genuinely asking the question, right? has Microsoft got the magic back? Because I know we talk a lot about Microsoft, right? And most of us would admit that the Microsoft we see today is not the Microsoft that we've kind of grown accustomed to under the Ballmer era, right? I mean, they've got, what have they got? I mean, Azure is kicking ass, right? They've got some Linux thing going on with software-defined switching.
SQL on Linux.
SQL server on Linux. Thank you, Lauren. Brilliant shout there. I'd forgotten about that one. Now, Microsoft FreeBSD for Azure. So, and apparently they're going to support it in the Azure cloud. And they're doing all the cool stuff like giving back to the community and all the things that, you know, you would just never expect from Microsoft. I don't know, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, even like 20 years ago, no more that closed shop. So I'm asking the question, and I want your opinions on this. Has Microsoft got the magic back?
Well, they're appearing on podcasts, which has never happened before.
Oh, there's another thing then. We ought to get
That's
them on
it.
Here.
Yeah, at least part of them, you know. Definitely the cloud part, I think, is becoming cool, or really has been cool for quite a while now. I mean, they're making some great moves, and they're still surprising me every time, you know?
I mean, I think their Azure cloud platform is good, but they're also executing on it like crazy. So it seems, from where I stand, at least, right?
No, they're definitely hitting on all strides right now. And, you know, this is, if anything, to define the fact that this is so far and removed away from the Ballmer era, it is just the last 3 years and the complete turnaround of Microsoft. And the utter perception of them, you know, it's like nobody just thinks of it as, you know, they've abandoned the silliness of phones and things like that. They've gotten smart about streamlining operations. I mean, even their, you know, their gaming portfolio is even more robust than it ever was. It's, you know, and they've kind of hit their sweet spot. And, you know, when you're a Goliath, you know, when you're a battleship and somebody's trying to steer, you know, turn you with an oar, that's an effort of futility. And so they've had to make very broad strokes and very big movements in order to realign and readjust and kind of reinvent themselves for the new era. It's the same thing that Apple did.
Yeah, I think the cloud part of it, I mean, while that business unit or team or whoever seems a lot more progressive, I mean, some of it is necessary too, you know, like the FreeBSD, that will allow a lot of appliances that weren't able to be on Azure before work on Azure, right? The Linux move, that needed to happen for cloud. All of the Linux stuff, I think, needed to happen for the cloud to be successful. And I think they're doing a good job there.
Yeah, that was actually something I was really surprised by, them embracing that so much. And I think that was very non-old Microsoft-centric thinking. And you are seeing them bringing the sexy back into their whole enterprise portfolio. And I think that's really where they're winning. I think from a consumer standpoint, they're still having some of the old legacy problems that they've had in the past. But from a large enterprise standpoint, clients are really, really embracing a lot of the products that they have, because there's just a lot of knowledge and a lot of capabilities and talent behind the whole Microsoft stack that once they actually opened up, once they did those broad strokes that you were talking about, and move that to giant battleship, people just started to lap it up. I mean, Azure, you know, 80 in the cloud, Microsoft 365, as soon as they turned that stuff on, it really made it work. And all the Linux stuff they're embracing, people just lapped it up, because there's so much, you can't move against all that force of sort of that legacy knowledge, experience, and talent you have within the organizations for Microsoft.
So you know what? Just this week, I've been playing with Windows Server 2016 Technical Preview 5 with the native Docker containers on there. And I know that it's not as big and it's not as probably core to their strategy as something like Azure. Well, certainly not like Azure. But I tell you what, it's yet another thing where they've seen a trend and they're like, we're not letting this get us by. So, I mean, so I've got a Windows 10 laptop and I've had like the Docker for Windows beta on it for a while, which spins up a VM and it still runs Docker on Linux inside of that VM. But this Windows Server 2016 stuff, this is like native running Docker directly on the Windows kernel. And I got to tell you, I was not expecting much. And okay, so I've got to hold my hands up and say, right, I've played around with it for a couple of days, but first impressions are, it is slick and it is integrated and it is like, it is the same Docker experience that I get on Linux, right? And I've kind of been blown away by how well they've executed on that. And it just all adds up to me, right? That that there's a vibe and a feeling around Microsoft, at least looking from the outside in for me, right, that they've not had for a long time. I remember, right, when I was like, in my, I'm sure you guys all did the same, right, but in my late teens and I was coding, I used to write code in an old database programming language called Fox Pro that Microsoft acquired. But Josh, but the thing is,
my first job, I had to do Fox Pro coding.
There you go. Honestly, right?
And Visual Fox Pro.
Yeah. So it kind of died when it went to Visual Fox Pro 3, really. I think that was when they kind of started putting it out to pasture. But anyway, Fox Pro was great. But the thing is, right, I remember back in those days, right, Microsoft was kind of seen as like the innovator, at least from here in the UK, right, from a teenager's perspective, you know, this really cool tech company that was doing cool stuff. And I don't know, they seem to have that from the outside looking in again these days. And it feels like, you know, the things that are happening internally must be getting a bit more fun and a bit more exciting and challenging. You know, hey, I mean, I'm sure the guys in the Azure team are looking at the Oracle Cloud all the time and have got pictures of it up around the office saying, we've got to be as good as this, right? But there's something going on at Microsoft, I think, that's good. So I just want to do a quick round table, right? Has Microsoft got the magic back? Yes or no? Gabriel?
Yeah, most certainly.
Good. Lauren?
Yes.
Yadin?
Oh, yeah.
It's official then. That is 4 out of 4. Microsoft has the magic back.
Wow, that's like a first time ever.
I know, yeah.
Right, hey, Nigel, okay, so, quick, how's the level right now? Is it better than
Gabriel,
what
it is sweet. I cannot tell you how
good
it is.
Yeah, you sound good.
I am made up, mate. Honestly.
No, I'm happy. Great.
Because I've felt like really harsh saying how bad it is all the time.
Oh, no, I wanted to dial this in for some time. I'm like, geez, will you just work?
My favorite, I think, was when you were working on the sink and doing the podcast. The
Those days are in the past, sadly, because it was funny at the time.
It gave the show character.
It did. You're right. Texture and character.
Flavoring.
And now it's your job, Yadin, to give us the character that we've no longer got from Gabriel's background noise. No pressure.
Oh, yeah. Well, you'll find I'll be a bit reserved for this episode, but as they go on, if I've passed the job interview today, you'll find me getting a little less and less reserved.
Pressure off. You already passed. It's not what you know. It's who you know. You know Farley, and he got you in the back door, so no worries. Tell you what, though, let's switch tack to business news, right? Let's take this one about Cisco first, because I know, Lauren, you're going to give us the inside spiel on this. And, you know, no comment, is it, before we go?
No comment, as always. I mean, I can tell you the story or whatever, but I can't really, you know, comment on.
No, I'll be interested to hear you give us the story, right? Because the big picture here is that a bunch of the guys that have innovated, I'm going to say within Cisco in the past, right? Cisco's had this kind of policy under the Chambers years of spinning out companies so that they don't get suffocated internally. These companies, they spin out, innovate on new ideas, and then they get spun back in, right? And there's a bunch of guys, I think, was there 4 people internally that were well-known by the first initial of their first names as MPLS? I mean, how good is that, right?
A good one.
Right.
Fucking company. Anyway, under Chuck's regime, right, they were sometime last week, I think, had their roles changed or their titles changed. Seems like they've taken umbrage and they've said, yeah, see you later, Cisco. So I know you can't comment on that, Lauren, but I am quite keen to hear your take, at least, on the story and whether you think the strategy of spin-outs and spin-ins has been a good one. And if you can't comment on some of that, no sweat, right?
Yeah. No, I mean, I absolutely think over the last, whatever, 20 years, the MPLS have been there at Cisco, it was a good move, right? They've made their spin-ins have literally made billions and billions of dollars for Cisco. And it's good stuff, too. I mean, anyone that's used pretty much any of the main, like, Cisco products probably knows how well it works. You know, UCS, of course, being one of the more recent ones. And now, you know, what I work on, ACI and Nexus 9000, you know, the run rate's even better than what UCS had going for it. And UCS is now the second blade server in the world, you know, in 5 years. So, I do think that it went really well spinning in companies like John Chambers did with MPLS. You know, whether it created some some controversy within the company? Well, that might be, but I think stuff like that's going to exist anyway.
Come on, you can't make change without a bit of controversy, right?
Right, exactly. And, you know, it's a huge, gigantic company. There's always going to be controversy. There's always going to be people coming in and leaving, and I think that's just the way of the world, and we'll see how this next regime goes, you know. I know Chuck Robbins isn't really interested in that spin-in culture, so, you know, we'll see how it goes, but for now, especially for little people like me, it's business as usual, and just keep talking about how much we love ACI, you know?
Little people like you. You're like this giant within Cisco, in my opinion.
MPLS has no idea who I am.
Yeah. Oh, come on. It's only in Europe, our first name, babe.
I do, like, sit right outside her office when I'm in San Jose, but
that's hey, go give me some coffee.
Hey, I know why you've got a positive spin on the spin-ins. You wouldn't have a job, right, if they hadn't spun in the stuff that made ACI, right? So you're bound to defend
no
it,
one
yeah?
can pronounce NCMEA. Yep.
Well, I was going to ask you, Lauren, NCMEA. How would you... Go on, say it again.
It's NCMEA.
NCMEA.
Yeah, it means all together, I believe, in Italian. Yeah.
That's like harder than your dean's surname. NCMEA. That's
oh, yeah, syllable. That's way harder. See, Porter nice to find something that's harder than my last name to pronounce.
Well, Porter de Leon is like the like a Musketeers, you know, Ponce name. De Leon. No, it's the guy who discovered the Fountain of Youth, right?
Oh, yeah.
Ponce
yeah.
de Leon?
Ponce de Leon. Actually, I have the same birthday as Ponce de Leon.
Maybe oh. you're reincarnated.
Yeah, pretty much.
Man, that's impressive.
My favorite part of that Register article was that update where Cisco, I guess, called the Register to say that the advisory status was not a demotion. And I thought that was fantastic. Yeah, I think anyone who's a senior vice president who gets an advisory status knows exactly what's going on.
But also, absolutely. The funny part was they had to go back and change the headline with a strike through. Says, oh no, they just left.
Yeah.
Ouch.
Well, let's also keep in mind that. You know, Mario at least had already retired one time and came out of retirement to do this. You know, he's a brilliant guy, but he's not, you know, a young man anymore.
Yeah. I mean, I would love for them to put out a tally of just how much money, how much revenue those four people have generated for the Cisco organization, because it would be like gross national product for a lot of countries.
Yeah. Don't hold your breath for them publishing that, though.
Yeah, I probably shouldn't have said billions of dollars, but I think anyone can calculate that. Yeah.
The thing is, right, at the end of the day, Cisco will march on.
Yeah, I think I'm safe with my job for a few more months at least.
Cool. Okay. Well, I'll tell you what, moving from one Goliath to another. God, it's all about Goliaths this week, but this one's Oracle again, right? Now, the cloud must be real, because two Oracle Cloud stories in one week, right? So they're being taken to court in two separate cases, right? I think one of them was a whistleblower, a former employee, said she'd been pressured to inflate, I don't know whether it was sales figures, revenue, whatever. She's taking them to court. But then apparently shareholders are taking them to court as well, specifically taking, I was going to say Chambers there, Larry and Safra and Mark Hurd to court over doing exactly the same thing, right? Basically fiddling the books is what the allegation is. So I think very much the kind of thing that Sarbanes-Oxley is supposed to stop. Now, I could be wrong, right? But if this has proved to be true, this could be pretty serious, right?
Well, it's already serious. I mean, anytime you bring somebody to court, especially a large company like this, the ramifications we've already seen. I mean, Larry, I guess, lost, what, $1.4 billion of his net worth? Now, of course, he's still the seventh richest person in the world, so I'm not sure he's too upset about that.
So that's the point, right? That was my point, that, yes, it might sound like a massive number to us, but to him, I mean, at the end of the day, it's like, I don't know what the equivalent would be for us, but like, I don't know, a month's salary or something. I'm not saying is, you know, month salary or what he makes in a month is anywhere near $1.4 billion, right? But the fact that it really doesn't make a difference to him, he's not had to sell the yacht or anything, has he?
Oh, yeah, it would be like us losing a dollar right. Off of a boat. you know, while we're getting on to drink champagne and eat strawberries dipped in chocolate.
Yeah.
We would feel the same way. Oh, the dollar just fell. Okay, whatever. I got my champagne and chocolate here on this boat.
Now, I'm not getting personal here, right? I just think that the only way that you can punish in situations like this, now, I'm not saying that it is true what the allegations are saying, right? Just broadly speaking, in these type of situations, when you're talking about multi-billion dollar companies and people whose net worth is just fabulous, right, at the end of the day, let's be honest, the only way you can punish them is time behind bars. So, I don't know, just whatever the kind of financial ramifications, look, Oracle's going to ride it out. Well, actually, here's a question for everybody, right? So the shareholders, I understand, are suing Oracle and not suing the three individuals, which is that like a bit ridiculous that you're a shareholder in the company and you're wanting to sue it to take money out of it? Is there something fundamentally wrong about that, or do I just not understand the mechanics?
It's a fairly standard practice.
Yeah.
You should be giving us that money, or you should be maximizing. So the key thing is maximize shareholder wealth. And it's going to come in two forms, the stock going up or B, dividends. And if you don't get one of those two things, then you sue to find out what happened, or sue to get one, right? And so
Did not know.
Yeah, that's the only rule they have in business school is maximize shareholder wealth. So that's what you're supposed to do. By any means necessary, apparently.
It's not quite that Machiavellian, but it's pretty close. More and more these days, the MBA programs across the U.S. at least are starting to address that ever so slowly. But I think it's really interesting with regards to this particular case. When you're looking to, you know, maximize shareholder value and you're suing a company as high profile as Oracle, you actually end up hurting yourself unless you're completely divested. And anyone on Wall Street will tell you, and especially in this case, accounting irregularities equals sell. And so if anything like accounting irregularities happens to be within a headline anywhere, it's immediately going to be a red flag, which is why, you know, they had a stock price drop.
I had some numbers on that. Had it wiped $6 billion off the company or something like that, or was it 6% off the company? I really should have those numbers to hand. Again, like I say, I'm the worst podcast host in the world. The shares did take a big fall off of the back of that news, yeah?
They did. They did indeed. And I think it was $6 billion off the value of the business, which is not a small chunk of change. And if you're going to sue, you have to be a large enough shareholder for that to actually make a difference. And for these people, it did. And so it is a bit of a chicken and egg thing, or a bit of threading the needle. But depending on what, you know, what happens, or, you know, what your return has been on investment, if you want to pull out all your stock and then sue, then I think that's something that some people do. I don't know if that's the case in this particular lawsuit, but that's the only way to do it with a high profile company like Oracle.
Okay. So last story for the day then, according to IDC, NetApp are now number two in the all-flash market based on revenue for the first quarter of 2016. Interestingly, they've overtaken Pure, HPE, and IBM. Now, Gabriel, I appreciate your work at NetApp. Is it a no comment from you, or have you got some pearls of wisdom?
Well, I can always point people to the press release. but I will say this. As far as I understand it, I mean, I'm in you know, what do I know? I'm reading the press release. That's the same information I have. You know, they've done very well with the all-flash FAS. And that system, you know, it's like, you know, if you go back to Tech Field Day that we did at Sunnyvale, and Dave Hitz came in and says, you know what, we kind of missed the boat on flash. We didn't realize that it was going to be as big of a disruptor as it turned out to be. And, you know, if you think about it, NetApp was kind of the first to market with flash in many respects, and, you know, the PAM cards and some of the technologies they offered. I mean, you go back quite a ways and they had flash technologies in their systems. They just never made that pivot to making an all-flash product. And so, you know, they freely admitted that they messed up and missed the boat. And, you know, they came at it with a vengeance. They wrote key portions of, I guess it turned out that Waffle was actually very well suited to laying out flash technology and how flash consumes writes and reads and services those things. And therefore, it turns out it wasn't as much work as they initially probably thought it was. And then, you know, obviously you have a storage product with a significant background in data services that they can leverage and tap. And that's the biggest challenge that most of us startups had, right? You know, we didn't have 20 years of legacy host integration functionality, you know, to work with. We had to basically get minimally viable products out the door and compete in those spaces. And so, you know, now you get to come to market with a mature product, and this is the reward for having done that. So, you know, growing your revenue by 238% year over year is pretty significant.
So interestingly, just so we add a bit of clarity around this, those numbers there are at least predominantly the all-flash FAS, right? So it's not like, and I don't mean this in any negative way here, right? It's not like SolidFire has suddenly gone through the roof now that it's part of NetApp and it's got NetApp boots on the ground pushing it into accounts and things like that. This is the all-flash FAS. So like you were saying there, Gabriel, yeah, they were maybe a bit slow to market. They maybe missed the boat there, but found sheer serendipity, as it turns out, apparently, that Waffle, you know, the underlying file system behind the FAS, was actually not too hard to tweak to make it work with Flash. Fair enough. Okay, cool. Now, one last story before we go into hot or not, right? Huawei are apparently outspent Apple. Are we about to see the rise of a Chinese tech giant here? And should the likes of Samsung and Apple and people be quaking in their boots?
I think we're seeing something really amazing, but not in the same way as Apple, in a much different way.
Yeah, it depends, I guess, on how much of their product line has basically been cribbed off of everybody else, and if they decide to sell it in the United States or Europe, where they actually have intellectual property law.
What's it? Wow.
That's because that's what it boils down to.
Hey, I have a Huawei. Phone.
That's interesting because China is trying to make strides in order to change that paradigm. But as I think to your point, Gabriel, that is definitely the case. There's a bit of specious coverage for people who are trying to have that IP protection. But you actually are seeing people actually taking other people to court in China in order to do IP protection, which actually shows that there's a shift in the right direction. But of course, I'm sure those people are very well connected within the government and could see a favorable outcome due to their efforts. But I think one of the most telling pieces of that article is one statement where they said you'll find many reasons to find that the Galaxy is to be a superior device than the P9. And in this article, they talk about the difference between the Huawei device and this Galaxy kind of doing. But I think what a lot of people are missing is the innovation that China is doing that's about process innovation. And I think there was a great book out by Evan Osnos, who's a writer for The New Yorker, and it was called The Age of Ambition. And he talks about sort of the historical relation with innovation in China and how they missed out on the Industrial Revolution, and they're not going to miss out on the tech revolution. And people are missing the fact that China is doing these process innovations. Example is, you know, wind turbines and making them significantly less, for less money than their competitors. Same thing with phones. They're having these insane process innovations that are able to allow them to make things differently so that their price points, they may not be like, you know, a Galaxy, but the phone is going to be good enough and the price point is going to be good enough that it's going to move the market in their direction. And I think if companies like Apple or Samsung or others like that don't see that type of innovation as really being dangerous to their business models and seeing that as being incredibly competitive to their efforts to expand internationally, they're going to be caught flat-footed.
So we've got an expert on the podcast. Lauren, you said you've got a Huawei phone, right?
I do.
The questions for you then are, I guess, first of all, would you buy another one? And how does it stack up against previous phones that you've had? I don't know what phones you've had in the past, by the way. So, yeah, would you buy another one? And what is it like compared to what you've had?
I like it a lot. I don't know what part of it I like, whether it's because of the Project Fi stuff or what. But I've always been Android, early on I was like BlackBerry. But compared to other Android phones I've had, you know, the price point is actually pretty much the same, at least up until now. Maybe that will change, as Yadin was saying. But, you know, it's a $450 phone. I have the Nexus 6P. But the Nexus 6P and the 5X are the only phones that do the Wi-Fi calling. And I don't know. I think that's a pretty cool feature. So, I like it a lot. It's not much different than the other Android phones I've had, but, you know, it's not worse either.
Cool. I mean, I don't have a Huawei phone, but I do have a Chinese phone, the OnePlus One. And I've got to say, it's the best phone I've ever had. And it was cheap as chips, as they say here in the UK. Don't know if that translates well.
If you're in a small village, in the UK, That makes sense, though. But if you're in downtown London, chips are expensive.
That's right, yeah.
That's right. No, I got them tonight.
Any good or not?
Yeah, they were pretty good.
Yeah, it's comfort food at the end of the day. With fish and chips, I always feel like it's McDonald's, you know. I love the smell when I'm hungry. I go in.
Right.
And I feel like I've just abused myself within 5 minutes of finishing eating them. I'm like, I'm not having that again.
See, that's part of the nostalgia of the experience.
Yeah, absolutely.
You can just imagine yourself 16 after rolling out of the pub at your local village,
Nigel,
you know, rolling into the fish and chip shop.
You're always going to be chasing the dragon.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Anyway, so should we wrap it up with a hot or not?
Punch it, Chewy.
Yep.
All right, then. So let's wind out the show with hot or not. Over to you, Lauren.
All right. So I was reading an article earlier today that says Bing searches. I guess since we're doing a Microsoft Latter-day podcast here, Bing searches have been known to or researchers are saying that they may be able to predict cancer based on searches that people do for certain symptoms, right? So this particular study researched pancreatic cancer, and I guess they went backwards, you know, with people that did, you know, have pancreatic cancer and did their, you know, searches from months prior to finding out. And in, I think, 6 to 36%, they could accurately predict that they would get cancer. So, is this something that, I don't know if hot or not is the right question, but it's certainly interesting. And is this something we should probably pursue, as something, an early indicator when we should go get checked out, right? I mean, it's better to find things early. So I hear.
No, I mean, it definitely is. I mean, you know, as somebody who lost both his parents in the same year to cancer, if I could have basically cribbed on my dad's, internet search to alert him that, hey, bud, maybe you should go see the doctor a little bit earlier. That might have been helpful. I mean, it's interesting they chose pancreatic cancer. That's the fourth leading cause of cancer death in the U.S. This is like the perfect case for big data in my viewpoint, right? So I think it's hot because, you know, we want to take information. I mean, if you are constantly Googling and searching for the specific sets of terms, and it proves out that, you know, just by alerting you, you know, through some flag or some filter you opt into that, you know, you can go, hey, maybe you want to go see the doctor. Maybe that helps. I mean, it can't hurt. Unless they sell the information to the the anti-cancer drug people or something and they turn around and use it against you.
Right, big pharma.
And insurance and stuff. The thing is, right, you know, big data and all that kind of stuff, it can potentially be used for so many things. And I think we quite often think, well, how can we leverage it so that organizations can make more money, which is not in and of itself a bad thing, right? It's a good thing. But it's just not on the same level as saving lives at the end of the day, right? So I know things like, the obvious ones like breast cancer and testicular cancer and things like that, you can kind of, you notice lumps and things like that. Pancreatic cancer and some of the others that, you know, at the end of the day, you cannot find out for a very long time. You know, it's not that you have obvious lumps and things like that. The number 6 to 36% of the time, they were pretty accurate. It doesn't seem like a great number. And I don't know how many false positives that it would bring and, you know, whether that would worry people. But you know what? I think long term, that's probably not going to be a worry. We're probably going to get to the point where, you know, things like that should be alerting us. And you know what? A false positive is way better in the grand scheme of things, right? Causing you a little bit stress than not finding out in time. That's my thoughts on it. So I say this is smoking hot.
Mm.
I mean, look, I'm going to caveat that as well, right? Saying I think this is pretty crude and primitive and that, you know, in the future, analyzing big data and search queries and things like that will be way better at predicting things like this. But this is, in my opinion, certainly a step in the right direction. Smoking hot.
Yeah, I just wanted to pile on top of that, Nigel. And I think to your last point, when data or big data analytics gets better is really going to be, and a lot of people are already finding this already, when you look at different silos, like your smartwatch, your mobile phone, your search, and other data points, once you start aggregating those, and there'll be ways and services, I'm sure Google will probably do it, where bring all this data together in one place and across all of them, that 6 to 36% is going to go a lot higher. And if you can successfully start gathering all those different data points, then and aggregating that information to giving a clear picture and giving people real actionable data that's probably like in the 90th or 80, even 80th percentile, you know, accurate, you start going to get huge life changes and huge shifts. So I would say this is one piece in a much larger mosaic of what is hot.
Lauren, what are your thoughts on it?
You know, I mean, not much to add, really. I agree with all of you. I think it's primitive, but you know, I know I would want to know, or even, hey, just an alert, this is something that you should go get checked out. You don't necessarily have it, but, you know, we've cross-referenced you with whomever, and it looks like you should at least go get checked out. And like Gabe said, it can't hurt, right? And going to the doctor and getting it checked out, I guess it could hurt your wallet, but,
or your butt.
You know, that's what insurance is for. Well, that too. I guess I hadn't thought of that aspect of it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I agree. It's hot.
Okay. Right. So final question to Lauren and to Gabriel before we wrap the show. Has he got the job?
I think so.
Oh yeah. I didn't know we were interviewing people.
Yeah. You know what as well?
How much does this job pay?
Woo-hoo! Oh, wait a second. This is the second interview I had to do this week. Come on. Give me a break.
This is totally going on my LinkedIn profile.
You know? Yes. Right at the top.
Just to harass, you know what, other people online once a week.
Hey, that's a skill you can add.
Oh, trust me. I think I have competitive bacon eating.
Mm-hmm. Donuts are part of that. You can add donuts as a skill too, I believe.
Actually, being able to mute on a conference call is on my skill set. I think I have four people.
That's real.
That's a legit skill because no one has it. Except me, apparently.
So I'll tell you what as well. I did notice that Eugene was muting himself on the podcast as well. Always. There he goes doing it right now. None of us bother to do that.
I'm constantly muting because, like, good manners. Last day of school, the kids are out. I'm sure there's going to be a murder someplace in my home. You know.
Yeah. I was on the phone with a Fortune 50 company on a really critical call, and then I was in my backyard working at home, and my daughter, I didn't know the back window was open in my bedroom, and my daughter gets up and she yells out the screen, "Daddy, I got poopies!" And I had to mute myself, and fortunately, since I had the skill that Gabriel talked about, that didn't make it on the call.
Keeping yourself on mute's a good thing. I mean, I'd rather talk for a second or two and have no one hear me than, you know, all the other bad things that happen, because I've done some serious screaming at other people in the room during a conference call, and that mute button has saved me.
Cool. Well, guys, it's been a pleasure. Eugene, what a star, I can tell. Honestly, you're going to raise the quality of the you know what? You've even raised Gabriel's audio quality this week. I mean, that is a bonus.